This is the Rock and Roll Autopsy Podcast.
All right, I'm going to zap her again. Charge up the paddles. Come on, let's go.
Sorry, doctor.
Hold the compressions.
Clear.
Straight line.
Good evening and welcome to Rock and Roll Autopsy. We are the Forensic Files on your radio dial. My name is Scott, and have we got a great show for you tonight? No, we don't. Damn it! The phone is ringing again. It's the request line. All right, let's pick it up. WRNRA, east of the Rockies. Hey, breather. Missed you last week, man. What's going on? You want to travel back in time to the 80s? Are you feeling nostalgic for acid wash jeans, hairspray, and Cabbage Patch Kids? What do you mean any decade without the internet and our shitty podcast will do? Listen, you called the request line. Is there a song you'd like us to perform an autopsy on? The Heart of Rock and Roll by Huey Lewis and the News? You got it. All right, buckle up, gang. The subject of our rock and roll autopsy tonight will be The Heart of Rock and Roll by Bay Area rockers Huey Lewis and the News. We'll get the show started after these very important messages from our sponsors.
What the hell is this?
It's a DVD, Dad.
Oh, what?
A DVD, you know, of our show.
Coming to DVD.
Our show.
Unrehearsed and uncensored.
On what?
The show that's on TV all the time.
It's a DVD.
The Osbournes, the entire first season. Plus, never-before-seen episodes and the stuff we didn't show you on TV.
People want to see us on DVD.
Yes.
Coming to DVD March
2003. It's a DVD.
Yes.
Breaking news!
What is this garbage you're watching? I want to watch the news.
This is the news.
All right, gang, we've got our intrepid rock and roll beat reporter, Rico Rather, seven-time Silver Sow Award winner. You know, if you're ever standing around the water cooler and everyone else in the office seems way more plugged into what's going on in the world of rock and roll, there's only one solution. You got to crack open a newspaper and read my man, Rico. How you doing tonight, buddy?
Doing fantastic, but we've got, I had a whole slew of really cool things to discuss, but we've got some breaking news, man. Breaking news. This is less than an hour ago, as of this recording. We've got, you know, anything that's Elvis related is news to me, news to you, news to the rock and roll world. Lisa Marie Presley died. They announced it like less than an hour ago. So 54 years old, way too young.
Stunning. Wasn't she at the Golden Globes last night?
Yeah, she attended to go see Austin,
Butler.
Who played up. Yeah, she went to go see him get an award.
Yeah,
and he got an award for Elvis. Yeah, he won for Elvis, and so she attended. And then later that night, they took her to the hospital with some type of cardiac arrest, and then that was it.
Unbelievable.
I mean, she was the only child of
Priscilla.
Priscilla and Elvis, and that kind of ends the line for them, unfortunately.
Well, you know, her son had committed suicide like a year ago or whatever. Elvis's grandson, a family with a lot of tragedy, obviously
riddled with tragedy for sure.
I mean, it's listen. She just passed away, so I don't want to, you know, I want to be respectful here, but these things are like not uncommon whenever you have that kind of toxic mix of Godzilla-sized fame, drug abuse.
Yeah, I'm just going to say it, man. Anybody of that age, of that celebrity that dies in that way, probably under less than ideal circumstances, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, thank you. This is why you are the intrepid rock and roll beat reporter, because you tell it like it is. And
I'm gonna get talk about getting sued. I'm gonna get hammered, but
nah, you'll be all right.
Okay, I'm speculating. I have no way of knowing. I'm not accusing her of anything, but generally speaking, this type of scenario is drug related. Typically, drug related. Yeah.
Well, listen, since we're going to wander into lawsuit land,
may as well go head first now. Shit.
Do you want to get real? I mean,
that's why we do this. I thought
I'll get real.
Hit me.
With all due respect, Lisa Marie, rest in peace.
When you have to start something with all due respect,
you're about to say something really disrespectful. Elvis was Godzilla-sized famous when he's in the army in Germany, picking up a 14-year-old, 10 years younger than him, and marrying her. And then you have a kid, and then you succumb to your own drug problem and shuffle off this mortal coil way too soon, and you leave behind a really sticky legacy that all of them had to kind of deal with, you know.
So wasn't she kind of doomed from the beginning?
Yeah, right? So I mean, I don't think it's like you just kind of leave everyone else holding the bag, you know.
Yeah, that's true, you're right.
I listened to, I didn't finish it, but I listened to Marc Maron's podcast, and he had Courtney Love on there.
Yeah.
Holy hell, she's a force of nature, but I couldn't finish. I couldn't finish the podcast. But, you know, when you leave your loved ones kind of holding the bag, and you exit and you shuffle off, and you're leaving a baby or a toddler and a widow, and a lot of money, and maybe some drug issues. Hey, man, it plays out the way it plays out. You know?
Yeah, I mean, it's like I said, there's more of a chance of something bad happening than something good happening. Unfortunately, hate to say that, but what are you gonna do? You know, rest in peace. You know what I'm saying?
Listen, I'm a huge Elvis fan. Love his music. I went and saw the movie. I love the movie. I've seen every fucking Elvis movie, going back to the one John Carpenter did in like 1980. I've seen them all. Okay.
Oh yeah, Kurt Russell.
I've followed Lisa Marie through the years. She's a total hottie.
Oh, for sure.
Love the Naked Gun movies with Priscilla.
Although the whole Lisa Marie Michael Jackson thing, still trying to wrap my mind around that. But
bizarro world. Yep.
Whatever.
But but now is not the time, but I guess we already went there.
Yeah, we did. Somebody has to. May as well be us, right?
You know what? We're just having, Rico, we're just having the conversations everyone else has, but they just don't put it on the internet.
Exactly. Hey, nobody nobody listens to us anyway, so we're basically just talking to ourselves. So
we'll get away with it.
And we've got more breaking news.
Whoa, more breaking news. Holy
yeah,
cow.
Yeah, more breaking news. Yesterday, Jeff Beck, legendary blues fusion guitarist, died of bacterial meningitis. I guess it came on all of a sudden, like out of nowhere, and that was it, man. He was 78 years old, and honestly, I don't think if there's an argument for this, I want to hear it. But I mean, out of the big three, out of the Yardbirds, he was the most talented, wouldn't you say? Come on.
Oh, holy shit, Rico.
Not even close, right?
I mean, not even close. I mean, yeah. You're talking, we'll go ahead and we'll do the education portion of our show here, but the big three of the Yardbirds being Clapton, Page, and Beck.
Yes.
And Jeff Beck was just a singular, unique voice on the instrument. He pushed the boundaries of the instrument. This is a guy who was playing in the fucking Yardbirds in the mid-60s, and then you look at this fusion shit he was doing in the 70s. I mean,
ridiculous. The kind of stuff he did with that guitar is just incredible. The guy never fully ever got the credit that he deserved. Ever, because he didn't have the big hit, like you said. Anyway, go ahead.
We were funny last night because we were texting about it, and we were both simultaneously falling down the YouTube rabbit hole of watching Jeff Beck videos. And
yeah,
just Rico,
I know,
just unbelievable playing. I mean,
the way he makes God, the way he makes. Like the way he manipulates the whammy bar to make it sound like he's playing with a slide is a fucking joke, dude. Yeah. That's ridiculous.
Super vocal quality to his leads.
Oh, and absolutely.
To cycle back to your point, I mean, Page had Stairway to Heaven, right?
Yeah.
Clapton was in Cream. He had Sunshine of Your Love, and he had Layla with, you know, Derek and the Dominoes. I mean, he had Wonderful Tonight. You know, all these guys had hits, you know?
Yeah.
Beck, being primarily an instrumental artist and a fusion guy, didn't have that, you know? He had like a cult following, you know? But he was the guy. I mean, when it comes to guitar and just that kind of, you know, avant-garde music, he was the guy, man. He was the man.
Well, he didn't have a vocalist like they did. Eric Clapton was his own vocalist.
Yeah.
And Page had Plant. So he wasn't really interested. He let his guitar do the singing. And so therefore, he didn't really have anything that you could play on the radio like those guys did.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, when you have a Stairway to Heaven or a Layla, you know, associated with your act, I mean, those songs become like immortal, right? And it's like they just carry you for the forever, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They become more than songs. They become like just part of the cultural zeitgeist. But like, you know, Beck just didn't have that, but he had great records that, you know, hardcore kind of music fans just have. He has the respect of musicians and like hardcore kind of music nuts who just
everybody in the biz knows who he is and completely respects the fuck out of him. So another big RIP, right?
Yeah, totally.
So that guy.
And holy shocking. Moly. Both of these, like, out of nowhere, shocking.
Yeah, no doubt, man. No, nobody saw either one of these coming, for sure.
You have any fucking good news, man? It's all depressing.
I do, man. So check this out. Where were you? There we go. Where were you in 1971?
I was zero. I was born in 74.
Yeah, you weren't even like a spit in your dad's eye. I don't even know if that's the way you say that, but dude, work. Like in 1971, Paranoid was released in like right around now. And it like, that's what, 52 years ago, Paranoid, like the godfathers of metal, man, they created Paranoid on this time period in 1971. I was almost born. I was in my mom's belly when they released this album. So yeah, Paranoid,
unbelievable, an incredible slab of early heavy metal, not proto heavy metal. This is, I wouldn't even know if I'd call it, are they metal at this point? You know, you can get into this whole weird thing,
you know,
about what is
not,
what.
Yeah, I mean, but they're not. And a lot of those, when I went back and re-listened to it a couple days ago, they sound, there's a lot of bands around then that sound like they do. They all sound kind of the same.
Yeah.
With the same like super talented jazzy bassist.
Yeah.
And this it's basically Cream.
Yep.
except you take Cream and you take your blues guitarist out and you put Tony Iommi, who's really not a bluesy guy like Clapton, but he's more of like your metal riff guy. And then instead of Cream, you've got Black Sabbath.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's the Paranoid record, man. It's just got some, I mean, top to bottom, every track is fantastic. Do I ever want to hear it again? No. If I'm going to listen to Black Sabbath, I ain't reaching for Paranoid. I feel like I know the record by heart. I love the record. I totally mad respect for, especially the entire Ozzy era of Sabbath is flawless in my opinion. But I just can't listen to it anymore. I can never listen to Iron Man again. I sure as hell can never ever listen to Paranoid again.
I know.
War Pigs I can do once in a while. Songs like Electric Funeral and Hand of Doom, you don't hear that often. Fairies Wear Boots, you don't hear that often. It's got Rat Salad, the great drum solo track on there. Planet Caravan. I think I've named every track on the record, but
pretty much.
But it's a great, great record. But man, about half of it, I never, ever want to hear again. You know?
No, because dude, like albums like this are, they're like in the pantheon of rock influence, right? But on the other hand, sorry, but an album like this is like super fucking dated, and like you can only take it so much, you know. And there's plenty of other albums out there that are just really dated, and you've had enough of it. You know what I'm saying? Like every Metallica album in the 80s, super influential, dated, been there and done that, right?
Yeah, don't need to hear it again. I've heard it. Never need to hear Back in Black again. There's just some songs and some albums I just never need to hear again. Doesn't mean they're not great. Doesn't mean I don't have mad respect for them, but it's just I'm so old that I've heard them so many times. Listen, if you're 20 and you're into rock, spin it until you can't listen to it anymore because you don't have the miles on it that I do, you know?
Right. So. Exactly. And, you know, speaking of Black Sabbath, you know that. Did you ever, this was 90s, did you ever watch The Osbournes when it was on TV?
A few episodes here and there, yeah. A
couple here and there. So you remember how just massive and gigantic that show was, right?
Huge hit, yeah.
I mean, that show made him more famous than any album that he ever did, going all the way back to before he did Black Sabbath, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Well, if you listen to him talk about what happened as a result of that show, they were all a fucking train wreck, dude. Like, both the kids wound up on drugs. I guess Jack went, you know, cleaned up on the show, but Kelly was a mess. He was a mess. Fucking Sharon, they were all a big, the show just caused nothing but pain and hassle for them. So what do you do as a result of that? You do another show.
Oh, they're no.
Yeah.
No, you don't.
Yeah. They're
no, you don't.
Well, you heard that they're moving back to England. He's like, I can't. Yeah. So they're moving back to England. And I want to ask you about this, but let me just kind of set this up. So they're moving back to England. He is not in good health. Like, he fell in 2019, moved some rods in his back. He's walking with a cane. He is not good right now, although he did say in an interview that he did recently that his mind is still good, his voice is still good, but his body's a wreck. He's like, he can barely stand, he can barely walk. He's going the route of Phil Collins, where he's going to wind up just sitting in a chair on stage doing the show, right? So he's like, when we did this show, he's like, in this recent interview that he did about all this, he's like, I don't know how the Kardashians can do this shit, because when we did the Osbournes, we were all a fucking wreck afterwards. And so they're doing this show. She's coming off of cancer. He can't even walk. Why are they doing this, Scott? I've set this up. I want you to tell me what in God's green earth is giving them the idea to do this, besides they need the money. And I doubt that they need the money.
So you're telling me that just because I'm slow, that the Osbournes TV show is coming back?
I don't think it's not called the Osbournes anymore, but it is coming back. Except this is them living in England now, Buckinghamshire.
Another reality show of their life.
That's correct.
Do the kids still live in the house? Aren't they all grown-ass adults now?
Yes. Well, Kelly has a kid with the dude from Slipknot.
Okay.
And I guess Jack has four kids now. But they're going to be in the show. Now, the older sister, who wasn't in the first show, is once again not going to be in this one.
Right.
But Kelly and Jack and it's their kids, too, I guess, they're all going to be in the show watching him fumble around with the cane and ask for burritos again like you did last time. I don't understand why they're actually doing this, because they don't need the money. They don't need the celebrity. They have all of that stuff. So what's the fucking point, Scott? Help me with this.
All right, let me help you out. Do you remember after MASH?
Vaguely.
Do you remember Three's a Crowd?
Yes, unfortunately.
Unfortunately. You see where I'm going with this?
Yeah.
When you have a hit show and then you come back and you do the spinoff show, that's just basically a network's attempt to continue the show. Three's a Crowd, of course, for people who are ancient like me, was the spinoff of Three's Company.
Yeah, it was
After
bad.
MASH was the no longer in Korea, back at the States, working at a hospital spinoff of MASH. And there's been a few others, you know. Hello, Larry was famously a, anyway, but.
Hello, Larry. I totally forgot about that one.
Somebody has decided that they need to make some more money off of the Osbournes and approach them about it. And they, given the, given the wet brain genius of the Osborne clan, they decided, hey, this went so well for us the first time and nearly destroyed our family and all of our relationships and our health. Let's do it again. I have no clue why they would, especially at this age. Ozzy Osbourne has Parkinson's. The last concert he played, he had to be propped up on like a stand, and they put him in a large trench coat so you couldn't see that he had like a stand that was like in the ground with like a back brace apparatus, effectively holding him up like
in place. I don't get it. So if you have Parkinson's,
so you would literally have him propped up on stage and you're concealing it in a trench coat. This guy has no health left, Rico. None.
How can you claim, okay, we know the effects of Parkinson's disease. Just go watch any Michael J. Fox interview. Go watch old Muhammad Ali footage of him trying to talk with Parkinson's. How can he say, I'm going to be back on stage because my voice is fine when you have Parkinson's? That's not true. It isn't true.
It's not true. And I got breaking news. So since you're breaking all this
more
news,
news,
can I break some news here?
Go ahead. Like,
can I borrow your fedora and break some news?
Do it.
His voice isn't fine. His voice hasn't been fine for 30 years. This is, it's, and you watch any live clip on YouTube, his, what you hear on the records is studio trickery. It's pitch shifting. It's multiple takes. It's like they're cutting those fucking vocal lines by syllable and scotch taping them together to comp together some kind of passable vocal performance out of Ozzy Osbourne.
You get no time to think about this. I didn't answer immediately. Ready? Whose voice is more toast? Ozzy's or Paul Stanley's? Ready, set, go.
Oh, Ozzy.
You think so?
Yes.
Yeah, I would agree. I'd agree with you.
I mean, Ozzy's got Parkinson's and he's almost 80. I know Paul Stanley's in his mid-60s now, but at least Paul, like...
They're not 70 yet?
He's got to be close, yeah, but they're at least closer. Paul is like an avid bicyclist, and he's, you know, he eats really well. Got the guy post every picture of every fucking meal he makes on the internet.
So. I mean, he is generally speaking in really good health.
Yes, yes. Is his voice toast? Yes, but Ozzy Osbourne is barely alive. There's a difference.
True. You know whose voice isn't toast is Gene Simmons' voice. I watched some footage of him doing a thing just a couple of nights ago. He sounds great still, man.
He does. Well, that's the best part about Gene never sang. Paul got into that fucking range where he is so high. Ozzy singing super high in that crazy range. Gene never attempted that shit.
No.
Gene sang comfortably in a comfortable
register. He stayed in his wheelhouse, man.
Yes, he did. He never went on record singing in some crazy nutty ass register that he is not going to be able to do.
The 80s super high shit. You know who else sounds pretty damn good, actually? Okay, I don't want to get on a Kiss topic here, but I'm going to get on a Kiss topic. So, two things. First, Ace Frehley sounds really good still as a vocalist.
He has his wheelhouse. He never had to go outside of that, you know.
And here's a little interesting thing that somebody brought up. I can't remember where I saw it, but think about this. Which guy in the band of the original four did they have the most trouble with?
Oh, it's Peter Criss, I think.
Well, or Ace, one of those two.
Or Ace,
right?
Yeah. I mean, they were a dual kind of, you know.
Yeah.
But I mean, Peter Criss was the first guy out of the band. I know Ace was a huge problem, but anyway, make your point. I'm sorry.
Would you agree with this? Whoever said this said that of anybody in Kiss, that Ace Frehley was by far the best musician. Would you agree with that?
No, I wouldn't. I would think he had great songs. His solo album was the best. And just a really cool kind of stage rap and cool lyrics. But I don't know that I would even, I don't even know if I'd classify Ace Frehley as a musician.
I didn't want to be wrong on that because I mean, he's, every solo is the same couple of licks, right? His wheelhouse and his guitar playing is like super narrow, man.
Right.
Like it's really, really narrow. And he doesn't really, he's written some cool songs, but not that many.
Yeah.
And his solos also, so he's good, but I don't know, you know, I don't know. How do you define that? Like who would you say is the best musician in the band?
Paul Stanley.
Do you even say, yeah, because he writes all the songs?
Yes. Yeah, but we got to give credit to Paul. It's Paul Stanley is the answer. The best musician in the band.
He's responsible for every bit of musical direction they've ever taken.
Yes, and he's written the majority. When Gene was out thinking he was going to be a movie star in the 80s and banging Cher, I mean, Paul was
everybody else on the planet.
Yeah, yeah.
He's on a plane writing music, right?
Yeah, I mean, Paul shouldered the whole band, but it's funny. Listen, we got to get to Huey Lewis, but
I know.
I just watched a long interview with Bob Ezrin, who produced Destroyer, and he said that the story he told was that he was in the studio, he was in the record label offices, and Paul Stanley and Bob Ezrin pass in a stairwell. And Bob Ezrin had been producing Alice Cooper at that time, who all these guys looked up to. And Bob Ezrin stopped Paul Stanley and introduced himself. And he said, Paul, are you happy with how your records sound? And to that point, Kiss had released three albums, the self-titled, Dressed to Kill, and Hotter Than Hell, right? And he said, Paul, are you happy with how your records sound? And Paul was kind of taken aback and almost defensively said, yeah, I'm happy. And then who ends up producing Destroyer? Bob Ezrin. And because Bob then told him in the stairwell, well, if you ever change your mind, here's my card, right?
Yeah.
Well, those first three Kiss records sound like amateur shit. That's why the Alive records did so great. It was the first time you heard those songs actually sound good, because the studio records were horrible, right?
Yep. True.
Well, Bob Ezrin in this interview says that he gets into the studio with Kiss and he said, some bands, he said, they're all great guys, but he looked at them and said, you know, hey, that needs to be an A. And they all looked at him like, what's A? And so he said he literally wheeled a chalkboard into the studio and said, this is the language we're going to speak. And he taught them notes. He taught them
music theory.
He did a crash course on music theory. He even got them to play in 7/4 time a little bit on that record. And they played him in this interview. They played him a clip of Detroit Rock City where Gene does the lick, you know, the little fill on bass.
And
the interviewer says, well, you got Gene to do that. And Bob goes, Gene didn't want to do that. And so this was a band that was just, these are just self-taught. It's a real New York City rock and roll band from the early 70s. These guys were just writing songs, flying by the seat of their pants. It's honest music. It's honest shit. But when they got in the studio with Bob Ezrin, they didn't know dick.
Hilarious, man. Yeah, they didn't know anything.
And, you know, so, and he was polite about it and everything. But so that's why when you said it was Ace the best musician, I'm like, you know, for one thing, a lot of Ace's shit.
Well, I didn't know that story, but
yeah.
But we gotta talk some Huey Lewis in the news. So we'll be right back.
I was a fan of WMMS long before I started drawing the buzzard. MMS was a part of my life then and still is. We've come a long way together. When I draw the buzzard, I try to express in that character the feeling that WMMS has for Cleveland. It's a feeling that's in the music and in the people on the air. WMMS reflects the lifestyles of Cleveland and the North Coast, the rock and roll capital of the world. And the buzzard, he still says it all.
We are gathered here to remember rock and roll. Rock was born the rambunctious son of country, western, and blues. In the year of our Lord, 1955. On this day, the birth of rock and roll gifted unto the world a gyrating pelvis, a throbbing beat, and a pulsating rhythm, a sound so infectious and rollicking that it would endow previously scrupulous young minds with identity, individualism, and purpose, thus setting forth a multi-generational pursuit of all that is loud, debaucherous, and unholy. But, sadly, like all earthly endeavors, rock too must perish. Oh, we mourn the loss of rock and roll, with its ridiculously old standard bearers still on tour and charging ungodly amounts of Mad Jack to witness their long past the sell-by date asses on stage, and with its chauvinism, misogyny, and whiteness no longer aligning with modern sensibilities, and with its aging, fist-shaking fan base kicking every would-be rocker off their proverbial lawn, rock has indeed passed into the celestial void. May rock rest in peace, in eternal cacophonous slumber. Amen.
Thank you for that, Scott.
You are listening to the Rock and Roll Autopsy Podcast.
The Autopsy Report.
All right, so welcome back, guys. I'm going to do things a little bit differently, and the reason why is because of the where this album fits in when it came out. So, Scott, you sent me a YouTube of the Professor of Rock talking about this album. This is the Heart of Rock and Roll off of the album Sports by Huey Lewis and the News. Now, this album came out in 1984, and you sent me that video from the Professor of Rock. And just to put things in perspective of just how impactful this album was, he had talked about some of the other albums that came out in that year. Think about this. And this kind of, and it'd been so long and it kind of blew me away. So in what are the albums that came out in 1984? We had 1984 by Van Halen, which he did not mention. Bruce Springsteen, Born in the USA, Prince, Purple Rain, and Michael Jackson, Thriller. Okay. Now those three albums, he said, spent time at number one, right? This album spent time at number one in that year and competed with all of those albums. That's just how massive this album is, right? So we're going to talk about the biggest hit off of this album, which was The Heart of Rock and Roll. This album was released in April 10th of 1984. The radio version is a cool 3 minutes and 58 seconds, but the album version is a little bit longer. Label is Chrysalis. Johnny Cola, who's the saxophone player, him and Huey Lewis wrote the song. We'll talk about that. And Huey Lewis and the News produced the song. So there you go. Massive song, man. I can't wait to talk about this.
Thank you, Rico. All right, gang. It's Rock and Roll Autopsy. It's the Heart of Rock and Roll by Huey Lewis and the News. Hey, gang, whether it's called the Heart of Rock and Roll or the Heart of Hip Hop, doesn't matter. We got to cut this mug open. We got to do our job to determine if it killed rock and roll. And how do we do that? We use five scientifically proven categories. They are gratuitous boomerism, excessive misogyny, wanton whiteness, malignant machismo, and culture vulturism. Rico, let's get in the Wayback Machine. Let's time travel like Back to the Future. Let's go back to 1984 to jam with Huey Lewis and the News, the bar band Done Good.
Yep.
Gratuitous boomerism. How do you score?
it pains me to give them a one on this, but I'm going to do it only because even in 1984, like I thought about this, and the only other band that kind of had the same sort of style as them that I can think of off the top of my head is Jay Giles. Okay. I think Jay Giles had a similar sort of, they had a cool horn section. They had a cool keyboard, harmonica, the same kind of sort of setup, except they didn't do the love songs. Like, you know, Huey Lewis and the News appealed to the females, and Jay Giles really, that wasn't their modus operandi, if you know what I mean. But this style of music, I mean, the bands had horn section, but this style of music was kind of unique even in 1984. Wouldn't you agree with that? I mean, if they didn't reinvent the wheel, it was like super like rocky doo-wop stuff. With them, it was a little bit of new wave mixed in because their first album was a little more new wave-ish. But even then, I think it was kind of an aberration, right? Does that say that right? Aberration?
Yeah, I think
even back then it was an aberration, and so hard to relate to. And yeah, even now, even more so hard to relate to because of just the way they did things. And that's why I give them a one on this one, unfortunately.
Well, I mean, I think if I can piggyback a little bit off of your point, I think that there were some weird kind of outliers in the 80s that found success, even though it was a decade that when we think of the 80s, we have this visual idea in our mind, right? We think of Cyndi Lauper and all the loud clothing on, like, you know, Girls Just Want to Have Fun. We think of Prince. We think of hair metal. So we think of like fluorescence, big hair,
Duran Duran. You could throw that in there.
What's that?
Duran Duran.
Duran Duran. Yep. Flock of Seagulls. So you think of the visual, you think of those sounds, but there were outliers. There was a blues boom. You know, Stevie Ray Vaughan had his most successful time in the 80s. The blues came back of all things, right? The Stray Cats with Brian Setzer. So now you had rockabilly, had a comeback in the 80s, 30 years after it was huge in the 50s, right? Mm-hmm. And then you had this Huey Lewis and the News, which was, like you said, this pseudo new wave thing. I thought the Jay Giles comparison was great. This is a band from San Francisco, and I think it's funny that they had this Midwest success, because to me they sound like a Midwest band. You know, I don't know where Jay Giles is from, but I know the Michael Stanley Band was from here, right?
For sure.
I know Donny Iris was from the Midwest. And so the songwriting, the craft, the presentation, to me, Huey Lewis and the News, in spite of them being a West Coast act, feels right at home in that Midwest kind of sound, where you have these bands on stage with saxophone, keys, guitars, bass, harmonica, doing, you know, some straight ahead rock, some doo-wop, some new wave, this, that kind of mix, you know? So yeah, I mean, they were an outlier in that time, but to your point, tremendous success. This fucking thing sold 10 million copies and went head to head with Michael Jackson and Bruce Springsteen and Prince. It's nuts if you think about it.
For this album to even hit number one in 1984, it was number one for, I think, what, a week or something. But for it to even hit number one in 1984 is a freaking joke, man. That just shows you just how ridiculous this album is.
Like loaded with hit singles too. I Want a New Drug, Harder Rock and Roll, Heart and Soul, If This Is It. I mean, just chock full of hit singles.
Dude, I was listening to this album and literally as I was listening to it, even the cover at the end, Honky Tonk Blues, I think that I remember every single song on the album getting radio play. Yeah. And that is rare, man. That does not happen, especially for like this working man's rock and roll band that really only us Rust Belt folk in the Midwest can really relate to. It's like, to your point, ironic that they come from San Francisco, but they're more relatable to us working class people. You know what I mean?
And the song that we're talking about tonight, The Heart of Rock and Roll, I'm staring at the wiki page right in front of my face, and it says The Heart of Rock and Roll was developed after the band performed at the Agora Theater in the ballroom in Cleveland, Ohio in 1980, which they had been told was a great rock and roll town. The following day, Lewis told his bandmates that he felt the heart of rock and roll really was in Cleveland, and he thought the sentiment would make for a good song. So, you know, they do have that Midwest thing, you know. Gratuitous boomerism, it's a one. There's no way around it. It is a one. I do think that this has some legacy appeal to future generations, not because Gen Z would necessarily give a shit about Huey Lewis and the News musically, but because the song has a legacy in cinema, not this song, but this band has a legacy in cinema with Back to the Future, which has remained relevant to every generation since its release.
No doubt.
And also American Psycho, where Patrick Bates has the long dialogue about Huey Lewis's career arc. And so, because this band is so connected to iconic films, I feel like this band even, you know, could live on even if you don't know about the music, you know.
Very true.
And people may find the music because of those movies.
Yep. Yeah, you know, some people who, you know, like you said, are still very much into Back to the Future can explore, hey, what else did Huey Lewis, and then run into this album and discover just how amazing the album is. So that's a very good point. Very good point.
But it is a one for Gratuitous Boomerism. It's undeniable.
I think.
Given the nature of this band, but had doo-wop elements, for Christ's sake.
Yeah. And they talk about, like, another reason that it gets boomerism is because it uses the term backbeat.
Yes.
Ask anybody under the age of 30 what a backbeat is.
Yes.
And that's something that their dad did to them when they got in trouble, I'm sure.
Yeah. Yeah. This song is the heart of rock and roll. Could have been a Bill Haley and the Comets song from the 1950s. Yeah. I mean, it's got that thing. It's got the modern 80s twist to it. Thank God it doesn't have 80s drums. This album avoids that. Thank God it has actual drums, but
absolutely.
And not recorded with a ton of reverb. It has a nice snappy snare.
I know. That big explosive hair metal snare drum that just explodes the entire recording.
Oh, could you imagine if this record had that? It would be terrible, but it's...
Oh my God. It's so well recorded for its styling. It's so well done.
Rico, I listened to it twice today. And what struck me is it reminded me of, even though it's not as sugary and caramely as Hysteria, it's just got by Def Leppard, it's just got that same level of ear candy to it. You
yes,
know?
Yes. Every song has a cool hook to it.
Oh, hook upon hook, and just the ear candy, like Bad is Bad.
That's my favorite song.
Oh my gosh,
album.
I love that track.
It's the bluesy doo-wop song, and it's so bluesy and doo-woppy, and it's so dirty too. Like, not in the sexual way, but it's got there's so much dirt in that song, and I love it, man.
All the lyrics are super clever on the record.
Totally.
All right. Category two, excessive misogyny for the heart of rock and roll. Rico, how do you score it? I do have the lyrics up if you need to hear some of them.
Yeah. Why don't you help me out with some of that?
New York, New York is everything they say and no place that I'd rather be. Where else can you do a half a million things all at a quarter to three? When they play their music, ooh, that modern music, they like it with a lot of style. But it's still that same old backbeat rhythm that really, really drives them wild. They say the heart of rock and roll is still beating, and from what I've seen, I believe them. Now the old boy may be barely breathing, but the heart of rock and roll, the heart of rock and roll is still beating. The next verse is where we mention the opposite sex, which may be relevant to this category.
Sure.
L.A., Hollywood, and the Sunset Strip is something everyone should see. Neon lights and those pretty, pretty girls all dressed so scantily. When they play their music, that hard rock music, they like it with a lot of flash, but it's still that same old backbeat rhythm that really, really kicks them in the...
So,
what do you think?
I mean, the only even mention of a female is that they're dressed scantily, but dude, guess what? Memo to people who didn't live in the 80s, they dressed scantily, okay?
Yeah.
It's a fact. And girls still dress that way nowadays. It's just in the guise of like athletic wear, but it's no different. So he's just pointing out what was actually happening. And yeah, there's nothing misogynistic about that. It's going to get a zero for me.
Yeah, it's a big zero. There's no misogyny in this song. No. What I think is cool that he's established, really clever lyrics. What he's established in the first two verses of the song is the East Coast and the West Coast. He spanned the entire country in the first two verses. It starts in New York, and he lays out the modern music in New York, which I'm thinking at this time is probably skinny tie CBGB stuff, yep, right? But then yep, he says, hey, they pack it with a lot of style, but it's still that same old backbeat rhythm. And then we go all the way to the West Coast, to the Sunset Strip, where hair metal is ruling. And sure, he says, hey, they play their music, that hard rock music with a lot of flash, but it's still that same backbeat rhythm. So in other words, he's saying, guys, it's still that same thing from the 1950s. It's just dressed up yep, a little differently.
Yep.
It's really
so
cool.
So well done, man.
Yeah, so well done.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a zero for me too. No yep, excessive misogyny to be found here. Let's move on to what I think could be an interesting category for this song. Category three, wanton whiteness. Rico, how do you score?
Okay, so here's the way I see this is you've got a bitchin' horn section, which I played a horn and I played the saxophone in high school. So like the Johnny Cola solo is phenomenal, dude. Like I couldn't play like that. Okay, I'm just going to say it, but the Johnny Cola solo is amazing. And that horn section is fucking rad as fuck, dude. And the harmonica, and that's all old school rock shit, man. Like there's nothing white about this song or anything on this album for that matter. It's all just old school backbeat rock, and that's black and white. So for me, I mean, you might have a different view, you probably will come at it at a different angle, but for me, this is going to get a zero for whiteness.
That the outro to the Heart of Rock and Roll, bang and air,
yes, with the harmonica coming over top of it.
Yes,
with the and the run, and then the guitar. It's like you're doing a call and response. So the horn's calling and the guitar's responding with the thing.
That outro is so funky, and it's so I sick, wish dude, that outro went on for like another. I don't want it to fade. I want it to go on for another 5 minutes. If the song is 5 minutes, I want the outro to be another five. I want the extended cut of that outro because the jam at the end is so rad. Am I wrong?
It's so funny that you say that, because when we were sorry, I bumped the mic. I'm getting overexcited about this episode. When we were kids, songs and albums were recorded differently than they are now. I think when we were kids, the song, and this is even when we were in diapers, songs were never cut off at the end. They just had outros that the guy mixing the board just faded it down. Fade. And so you never actually knew when the song actually ended because they weren't recorded that way.
Yep.
That's different than the way things are right now. Now songs have endings, you know? And so, and you can relate to this when you're listening to a song and you're jamming to whatever on vinyl, and that outro comes along and it fades out and you wish it wouldn't go away, right? How right, many songs, but just take that feeling and multiply it by 100 and it's the outro of this song.
It's one of the best.
I totally agree. I could listen to this outro for a half an hour and not get tired of it.
The outro is so cool. It's funny. Nobody fades songs out anymore. It's like a dated thing, but
why do you think,
I don't know.
Do you think the story is behind that? Do you think there's any, like, who made that decision to not fade it out and to actually create an ending to the song?
I don't know, man, but I can't tell you how many times as a kid I would just be cranking the volume on during fades to try to, I want to hear more comfortably numb, you know? It's like,
I know. I did the same thing when it was, you knew it was going out and you knew the song was ending. You would turn it up, and then pretty soon there was nothing you can do about it.
Nothing.
It wasn't there anymore. That's so freaking hilarious.
But having said all of that, it's a one for me for wanton whiteness for Huey Lewis in the News. When your lead singer, and maybe this is too inside baseball, but you know, we've already established ourselves as Northeast Ohio, and when your lead singer looks like Chuck Schadowsky, there's no other way to go about it. This is,
oh my God.
And
I didn't even think about that.
Listen, if you're anywhere else in the world, listen to this, just Google it. But
Big Chuck, no, if your lead singer
looks like Chuck Schadowsky, you know,
oh
it's,
my God. Holy shit.
It's wanton whiteness. It's a one for me.
I'm speechless.
Let's move on. Dude, you throw Huey Lewis in that sweater.
And that hat that he wears. the little fedora hat with the earthen tone sweater.
Yes. I can't see the butt chin and not think wanton whiteness.
Oh my
God.
That's fucking hilarious.
Category four. Malignant machismo for the heart of rock and roll. Fans, thanks for tuning in this week. I know you're on the edge of your seat. We're wrapping things up. What do you give it, Rico?
Machismo? No, there's no macho in this. This is just a guy, just a bar band rocker guy that if you listen to any of the other, I tell you, I like just to go more on the album for a second. And this is why I'm giving it a zero for machismo, because if this is it, the breakup song that's on here, the really, really doo-woppy song, if this is it, is probably the greatest breakup song ever written.
Oh, yeah. It's beautiful.
And it's talk about, I've had that song stuck in my head for like 4 days now, and I can't make it go away. And I don't want to, because it's so amazing. It's the greatest breakup song ever written. And you can't have machismo and do a breakup song that well. And so it gets a big fat zero for me for Heart of Rock and Roll. That is.
In 1984, I was in the fourth grade, and 1984 is really the year I discovered music. And it was the year that I'd get birthday money and I'd save it up, you know, or Christmas money. And I started buying my own cassettes. You know, I think for my birthday one year, I got a boombox from. And so I had like the little dual cassette player on it that was big at the time. And this was one of the first cassettes I ever bought. And I bought Born in the USA. I bought Huey Lewis in the News. And I loved this whole record. And so it just to hear it and spend time with it just takes me back. It's one of the first things that I listened to and that I made my own. Like I found my own music, you know?
Yeah, totally.
And I was in the fourth grade. So the Heart of Rock and Roll was a hit. And when you're in the fourth grade, you're going to take the word heart and you're going to substitute fart and you're going to have a great time with this song. You know what I mean? I mean, I could do that today.
So true. And I mean, today's no different than back then, right?
Oh, hell no.
Then they chronologically disorder.
They give you the opportunity to not say, but say the word ass in the song where they do the doom, 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 you know?
Yes. That really, really kicks you in the, and then we're all like, ass.
Yes. And when you're in the fourth grade, you need that, you know? And that's a hook, man. Believe it or not. That little thing, even though the chorus is a hook and there's hooks everywhere, but that's a hook too. Those two moments, the little drum part that substitutes the word ass and the break at the end where he goes, dit, 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 dit.
Oh, I know. God, so great. Damn.
But
I just want, and you know what? Just a quick aside on this whole album. I work with a 25-year-old who is, he's the one that turned me on to Turnstile. Okay. And then remember we talked about Turnstile, which is a really great band, by the way, but he's pretty, like, he watches Columbo. Okay. So he's pretty, his palate is pretty big, right? When it comes to music and movies and whatever, and especially music, he wants nothing to do with Huey Lewis and the News. And I'm like, bro, you are missing out, man. You are so missing out. God, it's just, this is like, just look up rock, like old school rock in the dictionary, and you're going to see a passage about this album, dude. It's just, and this song especially.
But you know what I appreciate about him, Rico? Maybe it's just the Midwest thing, but I just appreciate the fact that they're just a legit working band.
Yeah.
You know, these guys are just working musicians. They're just a bar band that done good, you know? Eh,
that's totally it, man. Oh, and by the way, if you watch look up the Professor of Rock YouTube video where he interviews Huey Lewis and talks about this song and this album, the passage that you read in Wikipedia about him writing this song about Cleveland is it's true. It's right out of Huey Lewis's mouth. So that wiki page is not bullshitting anybody. He wrote this song about Cleveland, Ohio. So just remember that.
Yeah, it may be hard to people outside the area to understand like why the Rock Hall is here or why someone like Huey Lewis from San Francisco would have
like
those
feelings. How many big names has Northeast Ohio produced in order to justify having this song written about them, right? From an outsider's perspective?
Right. But I guess not to totally have a digression here, but you know, part of it is, you know, MMS was huge back then. Bands were broke in the Midwest in this area. Mm-hmm. You know, Rush, Bruce Springsteen, David Bowie. So, you know, bands, they had the World Series of Rock here back at old Cleveland Stadium that held 100,000 people, and they'd pack that fucking thing for 3 days. I mean, it was just like rock music, not just Cleveland, but in the Midwest, you know, Detroit and Cleveland. Rock music was just huge in this area in the 60s and 70s. And it just kind of set the template, you know. And that's not really the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. It's more tied to Alan Freed coining the phrase, a disc jockey in Cleveland coining the phrase back in the 50s. But this area was just, the Midwest was just super, super important to the success that rock had in its greatest era in the 70s and the 80s. So.
Yeah,
a lot of that had to do with WMMS, you know, and plus people in this area are just fucking nutty fans, you know, so that's part of it.
And that's what Huey Lewis said. He's like, you know, the fans in Cleveland in this interview, he commented, and that was the reason why he wound up agreeing that this was the heart of rock. He said, because the fans were just amazing.
Listen, I'll be real. When you're the butt of the nation's joke, you know, of like when you're a punchline on Johnny Carson every single night, you know, in the 70s and the 80s, and you're a butt of the joke in every movie, you know, Cleveland is always the punchline.
Ohio or Cleveland, it's always one of the two.
You have an inferiority complex.
True.
And so when you live in the West Coast or the East Coast, you're used to getting love. You know, every movie takes place in New York, or every TV show takes place in California. You don't get any love when you're in the Midwest or in Cleveland, Ohio. Sure. So when a band comes to your town and plays for you, people here, you give them any kind of attention, they love you back tenfold. So it's just true, man.
That's true.
Malignant so Machismo, true. I give it a zero. We got to wrap this thing up. We're going long. Culture vulturism. Rico, how do you score?
I mean, they didn't invent this style of music, but at the same time, like, they're certainly not appropriating somebody else's lyrics or music or whatever in order to gain fame from that. So, God, no way. They're an anomaly, dude. They're a big giant zero for me on this one, for sure.
Yeah, it's a zero for me. I don't see any appropriation going on here. Are there other styles that we've heard before? Yes, but it's rock music.
Totally.
You know, it's a rock song, but there's no appropriation here. Rico, what do you got, man?
Yeah, I mean, this is, I got one. I have 1 point, man. One.
Well, yeah, I've got two, and I tried to be as stern a grader as I could. So that gives us a grand total of,
that would be 3 points. So right where this song is, right where it ought to be. It contributed to rock and roll.
Absolutely. Science works.
It always works.
Yeah, great song, great band. One of my first loves as a kid was Huey Lewis and the News. So, you know, if they led to me listening to Slayer in a roundabout way.
Yeah, thank you, Huey Lewis, for turning Scott onto Slayer.
So, did you see where he's got like a hearing problem that's preventing him from singing now?
Yeah, he said like 30 years ago he got diagnosed with, I'm going to try and say it right, Meniere's syndrome.
Sure. Good enough.
And from what I read about it a little bit, and I don't think they exactly know what causes it, but he's lost, he can't hear musical tones. I mean, I think he has, because he does that interview and he knows what the guy's saying, so he can still hear to a certain degree, but he can't do anything musically anymore because the hearing just isn't there anymore. So that's kind of sucks, because I would love for him to still be doing this shit 30 years later. I would pay to see this concert right now. I would pay to see that.
Yeah,
and
that's
it's sad we're not going to get it.
That's a shame. Hey, science, figure that out and help my man Huey Lewis out. Help no him doubt. Get back on stage, because Rico and I want to go be those great Northeast Ohio fans who show up and love you. So
absolutely.
Get it figured out, man. RIP Jeff Beck. RIP Lisa Marie Presley.
Absolutely.
This has been Rock and Roll Autopsy. Thank you for listening. Good night now.
Let me have that special rock and roll music. Yeah!
Let me tell you, so the lyrics to real rock music is nothing more than satanic cyanide. Get it out of your house, throw it out, and burn it. It has no place in the house of the righteous.
You guys, it's like a mystique. There's no mystique anymore.
To the dawn, love it, hey, to the morning. I'm gone.
Follow us on Twitter at RNR Autopsy, or you can send an email to rockandrollautopsy@gmail.com. And if we run across anything good, we'll mention it in a future episode. Thanks for listening. Later.
Well, you know, that's just like your opinion, man.